So, welcome to the Sunday Night There Is a Solution Newcomer and Returning Members Meeting. Visit our website at oaontario.org, where you'll find this audio recording, additional podcasts, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. The opinions expressed are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. I would now like to introduce Leila. She's a member who has at least 6 months of abstinence, has recovered through the directions in the Big Book, and maintains recovery on a daily basis. After she shares, there will be time to make a comment or ask a question about the OA program or what the speaker has, as what she has shared. Leila, would you like a 5-minute warning, or are you going to time yourself? What would you like?
I am going to have a timer, but I would love to have 15 and then 5, just to make sure.
Good. Chris is going to do that for you.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Everyone?
Go ahead.
Did you want to share? You're going to be sharing pictures?
Yes, I am, if I could have the ability to screen share.
Make sure that that's allowed, that you in the security, that she can share the screen. So everybody, please help me welcome Leila. Yay, compulsive overeater from Idaho.
Yes, thank you. Well, as said, my name is Leila and I am nervous as all get out. So I've been recovered a little bit over a year. This is the first time I've done something like this. And in the old days, I would have run to food because that's the solution that I would have sought. Today, I have been relying on my higher power to just say, just give me the right words and to let me to share, you know, my story. Before I begin, I'm going to let you know, I want you to know, I'm going to be reading some excerpts from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I keep the words alcohol and alcoholic because they describe so clearly my disease. However, I am a recovered food addict, a recovered compulsive overeater. So when I was born into a loving Christian home, my parents very much wanted children, had suffered several miscarriages. And finally, at the age of 40, my mother carried me to full term. And so, I mean, they really wanted children. A few years later, they adopted a Korean orphan. And so my sister and I grew up in this home that loved us so much. My parents were teenagers during the Depression. So they, you know, as we were growing up, I mean, we did not want for, there was food, we could have anything. And as a matter of fact, when I started dating my now husband, when we were in high school, that was the first time that I realized that people did not eat ice cream in soup bowls, that they actually had little tiny bowls for dessert. This is probably why the four of us in our family went through a 3-gallon tub of ice cream every 2 weeks. My family was, overweight, nothing that I remember being extremely obese, but food was very important. As I was growing up, my dad worked swing shift. So my mom prepared that big meal before he went off to work. So when we got home here, we had had breakfast and lunch there at the school. We had our big, big meal as soon as we got home at 3 o'clock. And then of course had more food throughout the evening because that wouldn't have sustained us. And so I got used to eating as I was sitting and reading and snacking on anything. And I was never told, no, you can't eat that. So I could take anything out and eat it, whatever was available. I was chunky. I remember that my mother made all of our clothes and the patterns that she'd buy was the husky size for me. And I had an uncle that, of course, my sister being Oriental was small, so he called her Shorty, and he called me Fatty. And so I went through school, and yeah, I was not obese, but I was heavy. I definitely was chunky, that husky. And you know, it wasn't until I was before my senior year of high school that I did do my first diet. And my mother, whether she talked to the doctor or something anyway, but came back and said the way to lose weight was not to eat anything after 3 o'clock. So that is indeed what I did, which is now, if you look back at it, it was intermittent fasting, because indeed I didn't eat from 3 o'clock in the afternoon until breakfast the next morning. And I actually worked a swing shift job at the nursing home. So I got to work and I did not have anything to eat, didn't have lunch because I'd already eaten my meal. I did slim down and look quite nice for my senior year and even on into college. Got married and, you know, and then eating. I mean, my husband worked on Saturdays. He was in retail. And so I was home alone and, you know, and then it started to grab hold of me, and I would start to have obsessions about food, and to where I would, I need to get to the store. And in those days we didn't carry cash, I guess to keep us from spending, but I would get to the store. Well, I didn't want to write a check for just, you know, a candy bar or something. So I would have to buy more things and eat them. And then I would lay on the couch and feel ill because of that. It was, my disease was starting in then, and it was starting to, get me in its grips to where I would, you know, it would almost be, I mean, I was in such bondage. It had me. And I would be so compelled to go out and get this food. I finally did join Weight Watchers, and it was successful because I wasn't so heavily in. My disease had not quite, and I was able to do that. I was able to be successful and lose that weight, and kept it off, through the pregnancy of my first child. I started to gain weight, and the doctor said, "Hey, you got to stop this." And he said, "So just don't eat any sugar or any breads." Well, okay. And I followed that instructions and actually lost weight the last half of my pregnancy. You know, and then ended up going back into Weight Watchers and still was, you know, successful there. But it was getting a little harder. And on and off throughout my adult life, that was the thing. I always turned back. You know, I wanted to look for something. And so I would always turn back to what had worked before, but it wasn't working as well. And each time it would work shorter time. And you know, looking back, it was just showing that the disease of compulsive overeating was just absolutely taking hold of me. During this time, and one of the things in the big book, on page 18, it talks about that this disease, that it engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. And it brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, you know, anything, sad wives or husbands, parents, anyone can increase the list. During my disease, I would encourage my husband to take our children and go off to the movies, do something there so I could be at home and eat, because I did not want them to see what I was doing with food. During my children's junior high and high school years, I was the chair of the cookie dough fundraiser. I held that title for, I don't know, maybe 10 years. And I bought at least 10 tubs of frozen cookie dough. And when I had two children, I really thought that it was much more than that, and put them on the freezer. You know, that cookie dough never made it to the oven. I never baked the cookie dough. I never thawed it out long enough to do that. Instead, I would go out there and whack at it and chip away to eat it. I don't even know that my family ever got a taste of that. But that was just, you know, I had to do that. And I had to do it in secret. The things that I ate that were not meant, certainly things that were not meant to be eaten raw, uncooked ramen noodles, just sprinkle the seasoning on it. Any of the spaghetti things I like, because I like the crunch, I'd sit and eat those. Hamburger helper, eating the potatoes out of that uncooked. Biscuit dough that you would, you know, in the little cans that pop. I'd have those, and then I would hide the rest in my nightstand because I didn't dare put it in the refrigerator for fear that then my family would be wondering, well, what happened to this? So I'd have it in there, you know, and other foods. It was crazy. And it was driving me. I was driving my husband crazy, because then I would get him. I mean, I would be badgering him to have him help me. You need to help me. You need to help me. And that you can't let me eat this. You can't, absolutely. Then I would badger him because I wanted to eat something, and badger him so much that he would then give in and we would go. And then when he did buy it, and then I would be upset because maybe it was the smaller version and I wanted a medium or a large. And then I would be upset with him because he gave in. So it was this vicious circle that my husband lived with. I was crazy, absolutely insane about the food. I isolated, as I said, and sent my husband off. I isolated my husband because we didn't go places. We were going to go to a wonderful restaurant one time, have a wonderful meal. And I told him we had canceled the reservations because the next day I had to go weigh in at Weight Watchers and I did not want to have a weight gain. So here we were not even able to go out and have a good time. It absolutely controlled my life. And that we didn't go to friends. We didn't do things because the food just absolutely had me in its grips. So I sought out, like I say, slowly the progression of my disease, sought out my doctor to try and get some help there. His advice to me was just to stop eating, which I could not do at all. I did not absolutely know. I was at a loss, did not know what to do. As it says, in the big book on page 24, I would try, and most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. And the fact most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. And we're unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation, even a week or a month ago. And that was it. I didn't remember. All I wanted to do was have that. And I know one of our members in OA talks about that 9 seconds that the food brings me joy, brings me relief, brings me comfort. 9 seconds. I don't remember from the time, you know, how shameful and how I felt and that until, and so I just keep, as it says, I just keep doing it over and over and over again. The big book also talks about that, no one likes to think on page 30, it talks, no one person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. And therefore it's not surprising. Our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove that we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. Well, I ended up developing diabetes. Now, that was one thing. As I was growing up, my mother told me, you will never be thin. Your father's side of the family has big bones. So you will not ever be thin. And then she told me in her wisdom is that you just need to go ahead and eat all the sugar that you want, because you're going to become diabetic. And so you should just go ahead and eat up. And she really did encourage that. So I'm going to show you, let's see here. Nope, I do not have screen sharing.
Do we know how to do that?
I have given the right, so you should be able to do it now.
Okay.
Oh, thank you so much. Okay. So here I am. And that was probably near one of the heaviest I was. And my heaviest was around 208. So kind of standing off. I guess a lot of my pictures is that I'm kind of standing sideways, because then that way, I don't know, you look slimmer when you're standing sideways. So anyway, that was what? I did end up developing diabetes, and that was, I had good times and I had bad times with it. Starting off, but I had times in my life that I didn't want to be diabetic anymore. And so I stopped taking care of myself, and my A1Cs shot up to well over 10, because I was just tired of it. I didn't want to eat like that. I didn't want to. I wanted to be normal. I wanted to be like other people. I wouldn't want to give up what I wanted to give up, what I had to give up. Absolutely.
Excuse me, Leila, that's 15 minutes.
Okay, thank you. So when I was getting into this desperate times, and I was, again, my doctor said, well, just stop eating. And that certainly, he just did not seem to understand. I had seen a newspaper article or an ad in there, and it was an ad for a 12-step eating program. And it was at our local hospital. It probably didn't say 12-step, but it would have something to do though with food addiction. And so I cut out that, put it at my desk drawer at work, and said, okay, you know, and I'd look at that every time I opened the desk drawer. But my husband and son went away for a weekend, and I was at home alone with the food, and especially with the food in the freezer. And that weekend, I literally could not take the spoon out of my hand. And I could not stop going to the freezer. And it scared me. I mean, it had me, this disease had me in its grips so much. I was it was in bondage. And it did scare me, because I had no control, absolutely no control. So that Monday I called and found out when the meeting, found out what was, and was invited to a meeting. So I went in. I'd never done anything with 12-step program before. I may have had some vague idea, you know, regards to Alcoholics Anonymous. But anyway, went in, and I heard people talk about their stories, and it was mine. And they talked about recovery. They talked about the hope, and that there was hope. There was a solution. There was hope. And so I stayed with that program and got a sponsor and worked through that. Now, that program, I lost the weight. I lost, in fact, is that I will show you this next picture. I was then continually, let's see here, which direction. I got down and I was too thin. My sponsor kept telling me I wasn't thin enough. And at this point, my daughter was getting people asking her if my cancer had come back. But the focus was on the food. Absolutely, it was on the food and my weight. And that's where it ended. Didn't really learn anything. My reliance was on my sponsor. She was my higher power. And so but you know, I lost the weight. I was happy about that. But something came about and I left that program and I came into OA. I started that program in May of 2014. I left that in November and came into OA, November of 2016. And I floundered with a few sponsors here and there and didn't really do much of anything. Worked through the steps, but you know, that wasn't really, it didn't bring recovery. I just kind of worked through those things with them. And and I just wanted something more, just really, really wanted something more. I was afraid from my previous experience. I guess I didn't know what was going to be asked of me. I don't know. How badly do I want this? And for a while, it just wasn't bad enough because I didn't change. I didn't, I didn't seek out anything. I just kind of floated along in the ocean and kind of bobbed around and just was, well, I'll work through this or whatever. And it didn't feel good. It absolutely did not feel good. It just was not the recovery that I was seeking. So when I finally decided that I needed something more and I was willing to do anything that it would take, I went to the OA birthday party that was in 2021, and it was virtual, and I found somebody. I looked through the list and I thought, you know what, I'm going to look for a sponsor. And I found somebody listed there who said that they love to sponsor. And I thought, well, you know what, I'll just reach out and see what that. And so I did. And this person, I mean, it was like, well, how bad do you want this? How bad do you want to recover? Well, at the time when she asked that question, and we had talked a few days before that, but when she asked that question, I was actually on a trip. I was actually at visiting my son and daughter-in-law. And I was sitting in the baby's nursery on my phone call with her. And I don't see my son and daughter-in-law very often. And I said, I want it bad enough that I'm upstairs in this baby's nursery away from my son, daughter-in-law, and baby grandson. And I'm talking to you. That's how bad I want. And she worked with me and worked through, you know, there is in the big book. Well, first of all, I guess what I want to do is I want to look and see what I had marked over here with this. You know, the big book, it talks about this phenomenon of craving, and that it may be, you know, it's maybe an allergy which differentiates us. And the only relief we have is entire abstinence. The doctor's opinion tells us 6 times to put down the food. We have to put down the food, and we haven't even started on the steps yet. And that's what it's telling us. We have to put down the food to get that sanity to be able to work through. In the big book, there are only two times that the word threshold is used. Threshold, a point of entry or beginning. The first time is on page 41. And let me see which one it is that's doing that. Is that this is Fred. And Fred was there. He was business and, you know, kind of, you know, he had heard the story. He had heard about the alcoholism. They met with the men that Bill and Dr. Bob. And so he was in Washington, had been on business. It went very well, you know, during that time. And he was dressing for dinner, went downstairs. And as he crossed the threshold of the dining room, that threshold, the thought came, It would be nice to have a couple of cocktails. He says nothing more. And then as he returns to there, he's thinking, you know, that it wasn't maybe such a good idea. He crossed that threshold, that beginning. On page 160, there is another mention of the word threshold. And that, by the way, my big book is just so falling apart. And I have another one, but I have not transferred all my notes. So I'm picking up as I'm going through the pages. Anyway, talks about many a man has stepped over the threshold of this home. This is the home of the T. Henry and T. Henry Williams, anyway, and they had to open their home. But they had threshed over the threshold of that home into freedom. And that's what I feel like. I could, you know, choose before it was the threshold into my disease. That was my entry. I looked to the food. That was my solution. I isolated with it. I escaped reality with it. I definitely looked to it. So I would, if there was something that I needed to face, I didn't want to face it. So I just sat with food, sat with a book. I needed to escape. So I'd cross that threshold into that. But I am so glad that here, that now I have crossed over the threshold into freedom. Freedom from this, the grasps, the bondage, the claws of this disease. You know, I'm only guaranteed that a day at a time based on my spiritual experience. And so thankful, because working through the steps this time, working with a sponsor this time, that we worked the big book. That was what recovery came from, working through the big book and teaching me that, again, that my reliance upon God. Now, I had had a relationship with God most of my life, but I did not live like I believed it. And that was what the difference, working these steps this time, brought me to, where I learned to live and truly, truly live and believe that my higher power I could rely on. And when that came, oh my goodness, that was just it was such a moving experience for me. And the realization, you know, that it had happened. And it was a spiritual awakening. It was not the light switch experience that Bill had, but it was that slow. And but it was there. I'm so grateful for it, because it has changed my life. It has changed my relationships. Food just does not play an important part. And my relationship with my family is much better. Making those amends, growing close to them. Absolutely. So very, very thankful for this. I wanted to, and Harry was going to begin with this, is that every day, and this is in the big book on XXII, every day somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic talks with another alcoholic, sharing experience, strength, and hope. And that was what I was doing. And I wanted you to know, it doesn't, the recovery that I was looking for is, it's my recovery. I am doing this for my recovery. And in the big book, it says on pages XVI, this seems to prove that one alcoholic could affect another as no non-alcoholic could. And that is so true. Until I came into the rooms and had another compulsive overeater, another food addict talk to me that understood, because that's the thing in these rooms, these people understand. They understand me like no one on the outside does. These are people that I can share things to and share my feelings. I don't even tell my best friend these things. But these people know what I'm going through. And there's no way anybody else is going to understand it because they don't live it. But the people in these rooms do. And
Excuse me, Leila, that's sorry to interrupt. That's 5 minutes.
Okay. Thank you, Chris. It absolutely, this, you know, it also indicates that the strenuous work when alcoholic with another is vital to permanent recovery. And what I'll do is that I'm not going to end up taking because I'm going to the total 5 minutes here because I'm going to read this last thing from the big book. It says, it is our great hope that all those who have as yet found no answer may begin to find one in the pages of this book and will presently join us on the high road to a new freedom. So I would encourage those that are here, new, that there is great experience, strength, and hope in these rooms. There are people that have recovered, and they've recovered through working the steps and through relying on their higher power. And it's a day at a time, but oh my goodness, what the rewards are just so great. So with that, I think I'm done. I've run out of words.